I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Today, we hear from three Maryland women who have each experienced the death of a child from an overdose of heroin. We've invited them to speak about their experiences, the powerful grip of the addiction, and what it does to people and their families, because heroin use is on the rise again in the United States. And as its use increases, so does the risk of overdose and death. Heroin, the drug that has caused so many problems for so long in Baltimore, is now more common in the Maryland suburbs and rural areas of the state. That's where our guests are from. They join me after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday. Good afternoon, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Earlier this month, Attorney General Eric Holder labeled the rise in heroin overdoses an urgent public health crisis. Heroin use rose nearly 80% nationwide between 2007 and 2012, according to federal data. And Eric Holder said heroin-related deaths are up as much as 400% in some areas of the country. The death last month of the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman put heroin use back in the headlines, but for many people, many Americans, heroin addiction is nothing new. In Baltimore, in 2012, city health officials estimated that about 48,000 residents, or about one in every 13, were addicted to heroin. That was an improvement over the previous decade when the estimate was one in 11. While deaths related to heroin dropped for a period, they have been on the rise again. In 2012, 126 people died in the city from heroin overdoses. And across Maryland, the number of heroin-related deaths more than doubled between 2011 and 2012, rising among all demographic groups in all regions of the state. According to the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, Central Maryland experienced a 47% increase in heroin overdose deaths, while Southern Maryland and the Eastern Shore also saw substantial increases of 54% and 80%, respectively. Public health and law enforcement authorities are reporting that heroin has become a cheap, potent, and accessible alternative to pharmaceutical painkillers, which are now more expensive and difficult to obtain. The largest increases in fatal heroin-related overdoses in the state have been among younger age groups, 15 to 24 in particular. Today on the show, we hear from three women who are trying to spread awareness about the new face of heroin addiction. That stereotype of the heroin addict as a junkie living in inner-city Baltimore has changed. Barbara Allen of Ellicott City, Tony Torsch of Perry Hall, and Ginger Rosella of Calvert County have each lost a child to a heroin overdose, and each is here to talk about what heroin addiction looks like today and what it can do to a family. In addition, these moms are pushing for legislation in the Maryland General Assembly that would grant partial immunity the people who reported drug overdose to emergency responders. We'll talk about that legislation, that Good Samaritan legislation is called, a little bit later in the show. To start off, we welcome Barbara Allen. Barbara Allen of Howard County lost her son Jim to heroin addiction some years ago. She's now here to tell us his story. Barbara, thank you for coming in. Thanks. Nice to have you with us here today.
Well, thank you, Dan. I appreciate it.
Today is a special day, you told me before we got on the air.
Well, it is. It's a good day. It's a sad day. Today is the 11th anniversary of Jim's passing.
March 19th,
2003. And I choose to believe that my son and our kids, those who've passed over, including my niece, who also lost her life to heroin, that they're pulling together to get us in places like this. So for me, it's a gift to be here and to share our stories with other people. We're about helping other people. We're about making them aware. We're about saving lives. There's no going back. I've also lost a brother to this disease of addiction. So for me, this is very, very personal. There's three people whose lives have been claimed, two to heroin specifically. And I can't bring them back. But if we can do anything to save other people, to save other parents from going through what we've gone through, then telling our stories is fabulous. One of the things that I started a couple years ago was we started handing out these wristbands that say no shame or blame, just love. Because we find that the stigma behind the disease of addiction, and I want to clarify that there's substance use, substance abuse, and the disease. Today, the disease is referred to as substance use disorder in the medical community, but I think of it as a disease of addiction.
Why no shame? What does it said? No shame, no...
No shame or blame, just
blame.
Love.
Okay.
When people have the stigma of addiction or substance-related things, they don't seek help. They don't tell anybody. They think they're alone. They think they're the only ones on the planet whose son or daughter or sibling or relative or grandchild has got a problem with substances of any kind, whether it's alcohol or bath salts, whatever. So if there's the shame, then you don't get help. You don't talk. And then you suffer because you're terrified for your child's life or your loved one's life, and you don't speak to other people.
Was that true in your case?
Oh, my
gosh.
And
with Jim, when Jim was going through his addiction?
Now, I went through it for 22 years. So I come in at a very different orientation. My trek with Jim started October of 1981. I was home one morning. Unusually, I got a phone call from the school telling me he hadn't been in school for 6 weeks.
How old was he?
14. And I was shocked because I hadn't been notified. And when I went to his room and started looking, I found, you'd call it no-dos, basically, that came from an out-of-state provider. And as I began to explore a little bit more, I found some pot, marijuana, and that was our journey. We lived this for 22 years before he overdosed. He had great years. He was funny. He was generous to a fault. He loved barbecue. He harassed my husband, who's his stepdad, about what a crummy barbecuer he was, and taught Tom, you know, how to work a grill. He loved to fish and grow things.
Did he work? Was he employed?
He did. He loved to work. That was one thing about Jim. He liked being busy. He didn't care really what it was.
What did he do?
In the end, he had become an expert in the plastics manufacturing industry. They called him the machine whisperer. He worked
the machine whisperer?
Yes.
He could make machines work that other men couldn't.
That's correct.
Huh.
He worked in Jessup for a while. And in the plastics manufacturing world, a lot of the machinery is very old. And they just have to jerry-rig it and keep it going the best they can. And Jim just had the ability to do that.
How long do you think he actually used heroin? When do you think he started using it? At what age?
I believe that that kicked in about 5 years before his death. He had gotten through alcohol. He had gotten through cocaine. He had many years of sobriety. When the heroin kicked in, and the first time I saw him, I said, that's not my son. Something had, it was absolutely very different, and it got him in a way that nothing else had before.
Can you describe that?
I remember very much. He was living in New Hampshire again, and my husband and I had flown up looking for him. When he first walked up back up to the steps of this place he was living, I knew it was Jim, but it was like my words would be, I looked in the face of the devil, that this was this really kind, generous person who was not there. His eyes were dark. He was bloated. He was reeling on his feet. And he was like, Mom, just staggering. We took him over to get something to eat, and I watched him, and he was not in control. It was not the same as under any other drug I had seen him or substance I'd seen him with. And that's when we really put the hammer down as best we could. He was at that time 28 and around that 29, and there's a lot of things that are a problem for parents when you have a child that's of adult legal age,
right? Because only so much you can get them to
do,
right? Had you spent a lot of money on treatment for Jim?
Jim had been in and out of treatments. The first time was when he was 14. The one of the people there had said to me, your son will not live to see 16. And my response, out of ignorance, quite frankly, was, you don't know me and you don't know my son. When I told my son what that person had said, he said, no, we'll be fine. We'll figure this out. There were rough patches off and on. There's no question about it. It was a lot of work, a lot of money, a lot of visits to rehabs in different states. Jim was, the more he worked, the better he was. And then he'd get, then the heroin came in, and it was.
And when you say heroin, you know, when you say heroin, it has this meaning to people culturally. We know what heroin is, and we associate it with Baltimore City, the inner city. Usually, probably not a white user, probably a black person who uses heroin. That's the stereotypical heroin user. That's what we think of. And Baltimore's had a long problem. So when you said to people, Jim, you know, he uses heroin. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might have been a friend, an intimate friend even. How did they respond? Because I think people are still getting used to the idea that it's not this stereotypical heroin user that we've come to know over the years. There is a new face.
By the time Jim got into heroin, I was pretty fearless about talking about it. I didn't care anymore. My issues of shame and stigma were pretty well wiped out. I had watched him battle. I had watched him succeed. And when the heroin came in, it was my worst nightmare in some ways. I thought it can't get any worse, and then it did. But at the same time, I was a fearless warrior mother. I didn't care. I wanted treatment. I wanted help. I wanted to know what to do. When I will tell you that I had family members that were like disowning, didn't want to talk about it. It was his issue, not theirs. And some of these family members have addiction issues themselves. One in particular said something to me that just devastated me. He said he should have died. He was a heroin addict. And that person came back several years later, lost his stepdaughter to heroin. So what is the stereotype? So for me, I don't care what people think of me. I don't care what they think of my son. My son was a hero. He fought for almost 22 years. He never backed down. And the fact that he lived as long as he did was remarkable. I've had mothers come up to me because I speak around the country and say to me, I'm so angry at you. My son died at 18 months of using or 2 years of using, and they were only 19 or 20 or 21 or whatever their age. And you got to live this for 22 years. When I speak to other parents that I've met over the years who've been with their daughters or their sons with 20 years of alcoholism or whatever the substance was, we sit together and say, what is worse? Losing him at 18 months, losing him at 22 years? The answer is there is no good time. Hmm. There is no good way. But I'm not going to be quiet about it.
Barbara Allen, you are on the board of Compassionate Friends. You write about addiction.
I do.
And you speak out about it.
I do.
In all these years, you know, it's been with you. You don't walk away from it still.
No.
And today is an anniversary. Jim died away from home. You said 11 years ago today.
He was back in Phoenix, which is our hometown, and he overdosed there. I had just been with him a couple months before for a family reunion and a big celebration, and he was doing great. He had was in a halfway house and walked out and picked up, and that's often when the overdoses occur.
Yeah, relapse.
Yeah.
Your takeaway then? For parents today, there's new focus on heroin, I think partly because of a celebrity death that I mentioned in the introduction of the show, Philip Seymour Hoffman, but also because authorities are reporting increases in usage, increase in addiction, increase in overdoses, and increase in death. And we thought we were going the other way, I guess, just a few years ago. We actually overdose deaths were in decline for a while. So we're seeing this again, and people are looking at it, scratching their heads and thinking, young people taking needles in their hands and using heroin, what are you doing? Why is this happening again?
Personally, I believe that we have a society with so much pressure, and especially with our youngers, but it doesn't really matter age, the pressure to be best and be wonderful and be whatever. We have an addiction nation, whether it's food, gambling, whether it's... But the last thing we need is some other substance, quite frankly, or some other thing. The big thing for me is there's no place to hide. There's nothing that's going to protect you, whether you are educated or whether you are poor, whether you are any race, any religion. My former father-in-law said to me when I was talking to him one day, saying, why aren't you helping your grandson, your only grandchild? you're an alcoholic. Why are you not helping your grandson? He said, I can't be an alcoholic. I'm a Baptist. Now, he wasn't an ignorant man, but there's so much fallacy. There's so much. Someone said to me the other day, it was a choice.
Yeah, people associate it with moral failing.
Correct. Yeah. It's not a disease. It's a moral failing. My response to choice is, if you have a plate of pasta before you and you eat that pasta and you have an upset stomach afterwards, do you know whether or not you have an allergy to pasta or celiac disease? Usually not until after you've tried it. Hindsight often teaches us what our choices result in. It's not always the choice that teaches us. It's the hindsight. It's the result. It's not that simple.
Barbara, thank you very much for being here. Barbara Allen will stay with us in the studio as we take our first break here on the Midday Show. And when we come back, more on heroin addiction in the suburbs, our focus today. We're hearing the stories of three women who each lost a child due to heroin overdose. Up next, we'll talk with Tony Torsch, who's visiting us today from Perry Hall. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. We're talking today about the surge in Maryland and across the country of heroin use, particularly in the suburbs and rural areas of the country. In Maryland, the number of heroin-related deaths more than doubled between 2011 and 2012. And as I noted earlier, that rise was among all demographic groups in all regions of the state. The largest increase we're seeing in heroin-related deaths is in the young group, a 53% jump among those 15 to 24 in our state. Similar trends are happening across the country in suburbs and rural areas. Attorney General Eric Holder labeled the rise in heroin overdoses an urgent public health crisis. We're joined now by Tony Torsch, one of three women visiting us today, all of whom have lost a child to a heroin overdose. Tony Torsch of Perry Hall lost her son Danny in 2010. He was 24 years old at the time. Tony, nice to have you here. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Tell us a little about Danny, would you please?
Oh, he's just was just one of those shining stars that you would never forget once you met him. He was funny, handsome, looked like a beach boy, loved the beach, loved sports, movies. He could go through parts of a movie, like play all the actors in funny scenes. Very likable.
We posted pictures of Danny and the Torsch family, and Barbara Allen's son on our Facebook page. If you have a chance, folks, you can take a look at that. How did Tony get started with heroin? And I partly know the answer. I want you to tell our listeners about this, because I think this is what the trend is in the United States. This seems to be happening to a lot of young men and women.
Dan, we believe that started. Dan was prescribed oxycodone after a shoulder injury when he was in high school, playing soccer. And he only had the one prescription, to my knowledge. And now this is, of course, I learned this bits and pieces after Dan's death. It seemed that after he ran out of the oxycodone, he liked it. And then he started to purchase it on the street. And I found out it's costly, anywhere from $20 to $80, depending on what strength. And I believe it became too costly, and he turned to heroin.
Because it's cheaper.
Very cheap and very accessible.
And this was in Perry Hall.
Perry Hall.
He was at Perry Hall High School?
He started out at a private all-boys high school, and then we transferred him to Perry Hall when we moved.
And when did you become aware that he was still using painkillers after the prescription had finished?
He came to me shortly after high school graduation and just practically crumbled in my lap and admitted to a pill addiction. But that's all he admitted to. I remember driving, my husband and I and Dan driving him to treatment, and I asked him, you know, are there any other drugs? And he said to me, I'm just not ready to talk to you about that yet. That should have been one of my flags, but I didn't question anything else.
Okay. Well, you were concerned about him having an addiction to the pills first of all,
yes.
Right? But he did admit it to you.
Yes.
Did you have any sense of that before?
Not one.
Before that point?
Nothing. Nothing. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary to me.
How do you do in school?
Towards the end, not so great. But I believe it was his company that he was keeping. He was very social, too social, always wanting to go out. And that's what I believed was, you're not studying long enough, Dan. If you studied, you know, as long as you were on your phone or you wanted to pick up more hours at work, I think he would have been better. And everything came easy to Dan. He never had to study for tests, you know, growing up. We sent our kids to private schools, Catholic school, for the most of their education. And everything came very easy to Dan.
He had an injury from soccer, you said.
Yes.
Did he return to sports at all?
Yes.
He played sports in high school?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he did. And then out of high school, even after he graduated, there was a, I would call it a rec league, but it's for adults, and he kept with it.
How did you become aware of him using heroin?
Well, that was different. He didn't admit that to me until I found things. There were little signs that I really just wasn't connecting. For instance, I had no teaspoons, and I thought, are they throwing their spoons out with their bowls of cereal? I just didn't get it. And then I started finding little orange caps, here and there, and alcohol pads. But sometimes kids use alcohol pads to clean their face, and I showed one of the orange caps to a relative that's in the medical.
It's like a capsule, right?
Well, not even a capsule. It looked like it fit over the top of something.
Oh, right.
And I didn't know what it was.
Like a vial, like a cap of a vial.
When she saw it, she immediately said, "That's to a needle." And that was my first.
Oh, okay. The cap to a hypodermic.
Hypodermic needle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I called his oldest brother, and, you know, I'm real big on including, you know, our family. I have three children, and, you know, we have a family of five, or we had a family of five. And I called his oldest brother and said, you know, we need to talk. I'm suspecting something else with Dan. And he went and searched Dan's car, and he found the tourniquet goes around your arm. And we confronted Dan, and that was how we found out.
So you had like a family meeting with him?
Almost immediately.
Yeah, right. And he admitted to it.
He tried to deny it, but then he admitted to it and agreed to go into treatment. From the time he was 17 until he was 24, he had been in four inpatient treatment facilities, two out of state.
How did you feel when you heard the word heroin?
I got physically ill. It's a dirty word.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been shocking.
It was shocking. My husband and I, we cried. I was sick. Dan cried. He agreed to go into treatment immediately. That was a challenge.
Did you understand, Tony, did you understand at the time that there was a connection between the painkillers and the heroin?
No.
So that was later explained to you.
Yes.
That kids today who are experimenting with heroin are actually using it because they started off using a painkiller that might have even been prescribed to them, something that
Correct.
Was good for them to arrest the pain of a surgery or anything, that an injury of some kind. Right?
Correct. I had no knowledge. No one ever explained it. No one ever said this could happen.
And then the idea that heroin could actually be cheaper than a painkiller, also news to you,
right?
And others, yeah.
$7-$10. Very, like, I guess in some places the cost of a pack of cigarettes.
Did you come to know how he acquired it?
Not until after he passed away.
What can you tell us about that? Would he drive into the city? Would he get it out in Baltimore County somewhere? Do you
right
know?
In our neighborhood, at a couple of the local, a couple of our local restaurants that you and I would probably go and have an Italian dinner or a steak dinner.
Really?
And that's where what I would call the new face of the heroin dealer is.
Were there other kids or young people, young adults in your neighborhood using heroin?
Well, I believe there were. At the time of Dan's death, we found out there were five overdose deaths from heroin. two that he happened to know. About a month prior to Dan's death, he went to the funeral of a boy that he went to high school with and kept in some contact off and on. And he died of a heroin overdose. And while Dan was at the service, across the hall was yet another girl that he went to school with.
All from Perry Hall?
All from Perry Hall.
Perry Hall area.
Right, all in the same.
And you said that you had heard that there were a total of five overdoses around
within
that time?
Within about 6 weeks of each other.
And Dan died in 2010.
December 3rd.
In December. And he had overdosed it? He used too much? Or he got some heroin that was mixed with something else? Do you know?
I don't know all of that. Dan had just come home from 9 months of being in long-term treatment in Florida. We sent him in In February of 2010, he came out of a 30-day detox from Pennsylvania, Bowling Green. They saved his life. Absolutely, Dan hit rock bottom. The next day, we had him on a plane for a long-term facility in Florida. And I think what happened was in September, people around him started relapsing. And he called and said, I can't stay here. I can't stay here. There's his friends were relapsing, his sober friends. And I can remember my oldest boy sitting across from me saying, "Don't let him come home. Don't let him come home, Mom." And we tried to come up with a plan to keep him in Florida, go to another county. We had relatives that were willing to set him up in a rental home that they had. And my other son was going to fly down and help him get started. And Dan called me the next day and said, "I'm at the gas station gassing up. I'm coming home." And as a mother, I said yes. And I tell you, to see Dan walk in that door, and he was my old Dan back. He was healthy. He was tan. And those eyes were shining again. They weren't dark and lifeless. And it was great having him home. And he was home about 9 weeks before he relapsed. And I found him in his room.
He died at home.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You've been, Tony Torch, involved in a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about, and you can talk to them as they relate to your son, Danny. First, the Maryland naloxone law.
Yes.
I wanted to let our listeners know a little bit about that. Could you just say what that is, describe what that is for us?
Well, naloxone is an overdose antidote, and it's only for opiates. If someone is overdosing on oxycodone or Percocet, heroin, and they're given that drug in the right amount of time, of course, then it immediately brings them out of the overdose. It's a miracle drug. Most paramedics, I believe, carry it with them. Of course, all hospital emergency rooms have it. And I heard the word after watching a documentary called Gateway to Heroin from Massachusetts. And that's the first time I'd ever heard that word. And when I started to ask around, I called our health department and our county executive's office for a meeting to try to find out where was that drug and why didn't I know about it. And I found out that it was available in Baltimore City as part of their Staying Alive program. However, they only write the prescription at that time to those in addiction, to those still using.
So you wanted it to be legal for it to be prescribed to others.
Absolutely.
Associated with an addict.
Absolutely.
Right? In your case, a parent. Or perhaps a sibling or someone, a roommate, someone who lives with someone who's addicted. And is that what came of that law?
Yes, that's what came of that law. There was a core group of people that worked on that law. Senator Klausmeier, Delegate Brumwell, they co-sponsored the bills, and it passed unanimously. And that's just another harm reduction tool.
Your interest in that, of course, is because of what happened to Danny.
Of course.
You thought, you learned about this afterwards and thought, well, if I had had that in the house, perhaps I could have saved him.
Yeah, I wondered. When I found Dan, I don't remember if he had You know, there's so much that happens, you know, when you find your own child. And, you know, my one son's doing CPR and I'm calling 911. And I only think that if I'd had that, I mean, it might have saved him.
So now in Maryland, if you're associated with someone, if someone in the family is addicted to an opiate, you can get that prescribed.
Yes.
And have it with you. Have it in the house. Have it in your car.
Right. Have right. it on your person.
Right.
Yes.
Tony, I want to talk about the Good Samaritan bills also with
yes.
you, because you have testified in favor of this bill, as have Barbara, right?
And Ginger.
And Ginger, who's also joining us today.
Yes.
So there are two Good Samaritan bills working their way through the Maryland General Assembly. And one is comes out of the House of Delegates. Its lead sponsor is John Cardin, Delegate Cardin, Democrat of Baltimore County. And over on the Senate side, we have a Senate bill sponsored by Republican Richard Colburn, right? I believe.
Correct.
From the Eastern Shore. Now, under the Good Samaritan law, if these bills were to become law, someone who seeks help in a medical emergency for a person experiencing a drug or alcohol-related overdose would be partially protected, meaning that that person could not be arrested or charged with certain crimes as a result of making the phone call, right?
Absolutely.
Right. So a little more detail on that then. So in other words, if you're there and there is paraphernalia around, for instance, evidence to a police officer that drugs has been used,
yes.
you can't be pulled into that if you had made the phone call.
Correct. Anyone that's offering any type of assistance, someone's calling for 911, someone's doing rescue breathing or CPR, there is a immunity from arrest and prosecution for only five specific nonviolent misdemeanor offenses. You know, drug possession, paraphernalia, underage drinking. If there's a party at my home and there's someone that's unconscious and I'm calling, 911, if the police arrive, this law would allow them not to arrest me because there was underage drinking in my home. We're not advocating for this by any means. We're not trying to give anyone a free pass. We're trying to help people live. So many times people are left to die. I can tell you that there's parents in our group. I have I lead a grief support group. It's GRASP, Grief Recovery After Substance Passing. And there are parents in my group that their children were left. There's evidence that they were with other parties and they started, I guess they fell into unconsciousness and they left. And purely because those that were with him were afraid. In some cases, there was a boy, he was on probation. He didn't do the right thing, but I get it. I get why he didn't call. He was afraid, thinking, well, his friend will come out of it. He always does. He'll come back. And people are left to die.
What is the status of that bill? And this is not the first time it's been in the legislature, right?
No, it's not. We're just waiting. It looks like the Senate has passed 476. It has to come out of the House for it to be successful.
What did you sense when you testified in Annapolis? Support for it? Because last time I understand some law enforcement officials were expressing opposition to it.
Yeah, actually, this time there were no law enforcement officials against it. The State's Attorneys Association had some questions, and we amended the bill. So there's no opposition right now.
So whatever opposition was there before maybe has pushed away because of the heroin overdoses that we're seeing.
I'm thinking.
And the success of this, there was a story on the Weekend Edition with Scott Simon on NPR about the program you mentioned in Massachusetts, Quincy,
exactly.
Massachusetts, where officers, first responders, are given naloxone, number one, and they also have a Good Samaritan law, I think,
yes.
there as well. And it's proven effective, and they've reduced their overdoses a great deal
yes.
in that particular city. So, Tony Torsch, thank you very much for being here today and telling us your story about Dan and about these bills that are important that our listeners need to know about. So thank you.
Thank you.
And please stand by. We're going to have more of this in just a moment. We take another break here on the Midday Show. When we come back, more on heroin addiction in the suburbs. We've been hearing these stories today of Maryland moms who each lost a child due to a heroin overdose. Up next, we'll speak with Ginger Rosella, who's up and visiting us from Calvert County, whose son Jake died last summer. And welcome back. I just want to note a mistake there with our promo for the second hour. That was the promo for yesterday's show, our interview with Dwight Pettit. We carried that on the Tuesday show and unfortunately re-aired that by mistake, so we apologize for that. In the second hour of our show today, we'll be speaking with the writer and author P.J. O'Rourke. Dan Roderick's here on Midday. We were talking about heroin, the rise in the increased use of heroin around the country, and with that, heroin overdoses and heroin deaths being reported in Maryland and across the country. And we're speaking with, so far, with two of our three guests today, all moms who've lost a son to a heroin overdose. And now we come to Ginger Rosella, who's visiting us from Culvert County in Maryland. Ginger Rosella's son, Jake, died last summer from a heroin overdose. He was 23 years old, and I'm very sorry about your loss, Ginger, and Barbara and Tony, but yours is the most recent one that we're talking about here today.
It's the 8-month anniversary today.
It was on the July
19th.
I want you to tell us a little bit about your son before we talk about his problems.
You know, Jake was the kind of kid that everybody loved. You know, he was just a nice boy. You know, I have four children, and I would say he was the sweetest kid that I had. And he was. He was genuine. He was true. And he just loved everybody, and everybody loved him.
And did you raise your family? You've lived in Owings in Calvert County this whole time, or did you move there?
The whole time when I was married to Jake's dad, we lived in St. Leonard. And so now I live in Owings.
It's Calvert County.
That's still
Calvert
County.
I say Calvert County.
I say Calvert County. Yeah. You know, other people say
I've heard
other
some
things.
Marylanders say Culvert County, so pardon me. But it's Calvert County.
Calvert County.
So, Jake, he had a similar story to Danny Torsh, right? I mean, he started in heroin after first getting into painkillers, right?
Right, because I believe nobody starts shooting heroin first. You know, you just don't go to that. Jacob was in high school and had wrecked his bicycle and had to have surgery on his foot at Washington Hospital Center. When he came home, he had to be homeschooled because his injury was that severe. And he was prescribed Oxycontin, and we gave it to him. You know, here's your medicine. We don't want you to hurt. And we did that for probably months. And then he went back to school, really didn't notice anything. And then, you know, he started buying it on the street. And you could tell when he was on something because he was real jittery and nervous and just acting even extra silly. We did rehab.
Can I stop you for a second? How old was he when he got that prescription? He had that injury. And
16.
So he was 16. Do you remember at the time thinking, Oxycontin, that sounds like a serious painkiller. Why are they prescribing that to my son? Or did you just assume this is what the doctors did? This was the best thing for him. And he was in some pain.
I knew that it was a strong painkiller, but I thought, you know, these doctors obviously know what they're doing. They don't think that Advil or Tylenol are going to cut his pain, so they gave him this medicine.
Okay. I just asked because I wonder if any parent would have stopped and said, wait, Oxycontin, because it had become associated with abuse.
Right.
I don't know when. That's why I asked you how old Jake was at the time. So this was, what, 8 years ago? Eight or 9 years ago. Okay. I'm not sure how much awareness we had about its its abuse at that time.
And then Jake did rehab. Jake also did some jail time for drinking and driving. When he got out of jail, he looked great. You know, I never thought I would visit my son in jail and talk to him through a glass window on a telephone, you know, but I did, and it about killed me and our family.
How old was he then, Ginger?
17, 18. You know, he did about 7 months in jail, And when he came out, though, he was clean. He was healthy. He had probably gained 20 pounds, 30 pounds maybe. And he was clean for a couple of years. And then
he did he finish high school?
He finished high school. He graduated high school. He worked full time. He was just a good kid. He wrecked his four-wheeler a couple of months before he died and took him to Annapolis, and he had to have surgery on his shoulder. And the doctor said, I'm going to prescribe you some OxyContin. Jake said, I was standing right there with him and his girlfriend, I'm in recovery. The doctor said, the short amount of time you're going to be on this, you'll be fine. Well, you know what? He wasn't fine. Jake had a very addictive personality. Jake was 23 at the time. I said, y'all don't think we should fill this. And he's like, oh, Mom, don't worry. I got this. It's okay. I said, okay, you know, here we go. And he continued to work and continued to function. And I didn't think he was using anything after the pills ran out, but he was. And, you know, pills are expensive and heroin is cheap. And Jake had only been using heroin about a month and a half before it took his life.
It was that quick.
It was that quick.
I didn't realize it. So he didn't have a long experience with heroin.
He did not.
Do you know anything about the heroin that led to his overdose, Ginger? Was it, did he just not know what he was doing? Was it extra potent? Was it mixed with something else? Because we hear about it being mixed with other things.
Jake's heroin was mixed with cocaine. You know, I just don't think that he really knew what he was doing. You know, I saw Jake about a week before he passed away, and I saw some bruises on his arms. And I said, hey, what's going on here? And he said, oh, don't worry about it, Mom. I said, because I had heard that he was, someone called and said, hey, Ginger, Jake's shooting dope. I was like, you got to be kidding. No way. I called
him
on it.
Was that a person you trusted?
That was another dope user. And so I was like, I knew he was probably right. And so, you know, because people know what other people are doing in that circle. And it was another young man. And so,
why do you think he told you that?
I think he wanted me to know so that I would help Jake. I mean, he knew that we would help Jake.
And so he was a dope user, letting you know
that my son was
because
using dope.
Because he saw Jake getting sucked in, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, addicts, they don't want to disappoint. You know, they don't want to, you know, that's why I think Jake didn't come forward and come clean with me. You know, I said, tell me what you're doing. We'll get you help. You know, just please tell me. And he said, Mom, don't worry. I got this again. And I said, please, you know, we'll get you any help you need. And I just didn't really understand how, I mean, heroin is the devil. I really did not understand how it would just consume you. And Jake was in the neighborhood one night, walked over, met the drug dealer in our neighborhood, came home, turned on the bathroom light. Another neighbor saw that. And Jake's dad and his younger brother found him dead the next morning.
Does the doctor who prescribed him OxyContin the second time know what happened to Jake?
You know, the office knows. You know, I called the office and let them know that Jake had passed away because I had gotten another bill. And I said, okay, you know, I'll pay it. But, you know, Jake is gone now. And, you know, what can I, you know, can I make the doctor accountable? No. I mean, you know, it's our word against his word, I believe, at this point.
Well, what do you
did
think
I pursue
now?
That? When you,
I mean, that's just jumps out at me. I don't know what the protocol is in the medical community for that. But the idea that a patient would tell a doctor he's in recovery from an addiction, and then the doctor tells him, well, a short regimen isn't going to hurt you, basically, is what he said, right?
Yes.
That fact that you just related to us, really jumps out at me.
Right. So. I mean, well, it's really messed up, right? I mean, but I think that doctors are really quick to prescribe medicine. You know, here you go, here you go, here you go, here you go.
Yeah.
And that's a problem. And so,
this does seem like it all happened pretty quickly to you. As far as you knew, your son was using pills. You know he'd been in some trouble, but he got out of trouble. You said he was healthy after that. And you had no awareness of him using heroin other than that phone call that you got.
And then I saw the bruises on his arms about a week before he died. And, Jake's dad and I were very public about how Jake passed away. You know, most people or a lot of people hush hush about that. And I did Jake's eulogy at the funeral. And the first thing that I said was, our son died of a heroin overdose. So that his friends that were there, and so everyone could see that, you know what, if you keep on playing with the devil, it's going to take your life.
I want to go back to Barbara Allen for a second here before we close out our show with a special song we're going to air in Jake's memory for you, Ginger.
Appreciate that.
People think it's impossible. They hear these stories and they say, well, it's impossible. Once that drug gets in your veins, you can't get it out. You can't succeed. What do you say to people who say this is an impossible, intractable problem?
Well, I'm the eternal optimist. If you don't do something, then you just give in to it. And I say absolutely not. My son survived 22 years of dealing with different substances. He did really well in recovery for heroin and had some amazing times. He did relapse, absolutely. So I don't give up. We've seen people, I've talked to people. After Jimmy died, we went to the place that he'd been living in Phoenix, and I talked to the director of the program, and they said, well, here's some stuff about heroin. What I want people to do is go to the Science Museum or the Science Center here in Maryland, the Baltimore or the Maryland Science Center, to see Target America, which is an exhibit that's open till September 1st. It has all kinds of information about substances of all kinds. It's the study of science or the mind and the disease itself is so critical. Yeah, there's some interesting things about drug raids and things of that nature, but I would really encourage people to get educated.
I'm glad you mentioned it. I didn't even know it was there. Target America at the Maryland Science Center.
Correct.
And Tony, from you, that same question when people say, oh, this is impossible.
Oh, it's definitely not impossible. I mean, they have to get into treatment. And they have to, they have to work the program like anything else that you're dealing with a disease. If that goes with meetings and your sponsors, you have to stay in treatment. Parents, they have to become educated. We have to educate ourselves.
The song we wanted to play at the end of the show. At first, I want to thank Barbara Allen and Tony Torres for being here, and also Ginger Rosella. This is the song that was played at Jake's funeral.
At the end of his funeral, yeah.
It's from the band Linkin Park. It's called Leave Out All the Rest. And folks, if you want to listen closely, listen to the lyrics as we close out with this show, the show with this song. And if you don't get them all on the air, you can go to my Facebook page, and I posted a YouTube video that provides all the lyrics for you. And I think it kind of speaks for itself.
It does.
It had a lot of...
It's tattooed on my arm.
All right, let's listen to this as we close out the show. Thank you, Ginger. Thank you, Tony. And thank you, Barbara. Leave out all the rest.
Been perfect.